Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from Google's Making in Science initiative, introducing Science Journal, an app to help budding makers and scientists measure and explore the world around them using sensors in an Android phone. Learn more about Science Journal, hands-on activities, and the Making in Science initiative at g.co/sciencejournalapp. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Coming up, we'll be talking about traumatic brain injuries in the military and PTSD. But first, algorithms are used to understand and predict our behaviors in all types of settings. When you're shopping at the mall or driving in traffic, sending emails at work. And in certain states, law enforcement is using this type of predictive data in sentencing criminals. A court case in the Wisconsin Supreme Court is challenging the legality of these risk algorithms. Maggie Kurth-Baker is here to fill out that story. She's a senior science writer for 538.com. She joins us from the NPR studios. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, Maggie. So how are law enforcement and parole boards using this type of data?
So these algorithms have been around for a really long time. Parole boards have used them for decades, and it's basically these questionnaires that have all this information about an inmate's background, criminal history, all this personal information, and they use it to come up with an estimate of how likely that person is to commit another crime. So that's one thing when you're talking about parole, and what you're using it for is to kind of figure out what services a person is going to need. And it's kind of another thing when you're applying it to sentencing. And in the past decade or so, more and more states have started applying those things to sentencing. And that becomes a problem because many of the factors that are correlated with the risk of committing a crime, you know, things like the neighborhood you live in, the level of education you have, whether your family members have ever been convicted of crimes, those are also just things that correlate with being poor and being a person of color in America. ProPublica had a big investigation of this back in May that everybody should really read. And they found examples where you have a white person and a black person being convicted of the same crime, and the white person actually had a more and worse criminal history, but the black person would get a longer sentence. And that is the kind of problems that we're dealing with these algorithms. The other thing is that how the algorithms work is often secret. So that's the primary problem in this Wisconsin case, is that these are often proprietary systems that are sold to states by companies. And in those cases, you don't know which questions are most important to the final outcome of the risk assessment. So if you have a sentence that's based on one, you can't properly appeal it because you don't know which questions mattered the most.
Mm-hmm. So what will the Wisconsin State Supreme Court decide? What is the case about?
So the case is really about whether you can use particularly secret proprietary algorithms in sentencing. But it's also got some broader applications. I talked to a researcher named Christopher Slobogan at Vanderbilt University. And one of the things he was telling me is that this relates back to the Daubert standard for expert testimony, which comes out of a 1993 Supreme Court case. And it basically reorients the standard of scientific evidence in the courtroom from what is generally accepted to what is scientifically valid. And it makes the judges the person in charge of determining scientific validity. So this Daubert standard is why you've seen so many previously accepted forensic sciences go up in flames in recent years. But it's never been strongly applied to sentencing before. And Slobogan says that this case is going to make a difference for how that Daubert standard gets applied to sentencing.
Interesting. Well, I'll be following up on that. Let's move on to Pat Summitt, who was a legendary basketball coach at the University of Tennessee, who passed away this week from early onset Alzheimer's, which is a rarer form of the disease, correct?
Right. So there are about 5.4 million Americans who have Alzheimer's, but about 200,000 of them are people who got Alzheimer's before the age of 65. So Pat Summitt died at age 64. She was diagnosed at age 59. So it's this small subset of people with Alzheimer's, but it's actually a really important group as far as scientific research is concerned. And that's because Alzheimer's is really hard to study. So you know how over the last few decades, scientists have decided with cancer that it's not just one thing, it's actually this whole array of different diseases that are kind of under one umbrella. Alzheimer's is a single disease, but it has lots of possible origins. It can look really different from one person to another. And there's just this shared pathology that everybody has in the end that kills them. So early onset Alzheimer's is more likely to be genetically linked. And there's actually a subset of people who have dominantly inherited Alzheimer's. So if they have this gene variant, they'll get Alzheimer's, they'll get it young, and there's a 50% chance of passing it on to their children. And that's a real personal tragedy, but it's a scientific opportunity because it allows scientists to start following the progress of the disease before people actually know and notice that they have it. So you can test somebody for this dominantly inherited Alzheimer's when they're in their 20s, before they have any symptoms at all, and know that they're going to develop it. And so you can start watching for biomarkers that can help with testing. You can start figuring out possible treatments. You can start better understanding what happens in the brain before the symptoms are even obvious.
The 5% helping out the 95%. Let's move on to China. Now, China launched a spacecraft to clean up space junk. I mean, they have created a lot of space junk themselves, haven't they? So what's the plan
Everybody's
here?
Everybody's created a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. They've blown up satellites in space. So.
Right. Yeah, that 2007 case where they decided to try to destroy space junk by blowing up a satellite that then created lots and lots of pieces of tiny space junk. Yeah, space junk is a huge problem. It's all around in low Earth orbit. We were talking about whole satellites that have been decommissioned and are just up there, but we're also talking about tiny little pieces of things, you know, from satellites crashing into each other, from wrenches that got lost. It's not just big stuff, it's also small stuff, and they can damage spacecraft. And they keep crashing into each other and creating smaller and smaller pieces that are still dangerous. So you have this new satellite, which is called Roaming Dragon. And it has a mechanical arm on it, and it's supposed to be able to pull up alongside a dead satellite and basically pick it up like a garbage truck. And then Roaming Dragon could be piloted into a safe crash landing in the ocean, and it takes the junk with it, which sounds great, right? Like, that sounds like a really good idea.
But. any but to that?
There is, in fact, a but to that.
Yeah.
Last year, I did a story on space law. And the space lawyers, which is a job at the time, were telling me that the problem with any system that can clean up space junk is that it also inherently can operate as a weapon, that it can be something that could take out a working satellite just as easily as it could take out a dead one. And that is a potential problem with Roaming Dragon. And it's something that observers of space law and observers of, you know, what's going on in space are kind of currently debating right now whether or not this is something we should be worried about with this particular satellite.
Right. I've seen that James Bond movie, by the way, where it actually did that in the movie. Thank you, Maggie.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Maggie Kurth-Baker is a senior science writer for the 538.com based out of Minneapolis. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. It's a busy time for research into stem cell treatments for disease, with hundreds of clinical trials underway investigating their potential for multiple sclerosis, heart disease, Crohn's disease, lots more. Pro athletes from football to baseball are receiving high-profile stem cell infusions and injections to treat injuries picked up on the field. The late hockey great Gordie Howe received them to treat a stroke. And a new report released yesterday has found 577 clinics, over almost 600 clinics right here in the U.S., offering some form of stem cell treatment for a huge range of conditions. Here to break down the good and the bad of stem cells is my guest, Leith Turner, an associate professor of bioethics at the University of Minnesota. He's co-author with UC Davis stem cell researcher Paul Knepfler of the report, which appeared in the journal Cell Stem Cell this week. Sorry. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks very much for having me on. Appreciate
okay,
it.
Let's start with the good. What are the known medical benefits of stem cells?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. I mean, so You know, most of us may know from our own family experiences that there are some stem cell transplants. Usually we think of those as bone marrow transplants. So if you think about family or friends, you may know someone who's had leukemia, lymphoma, other blood-related disorders, and they may have had a bone marrow transplant. So that's where blood-producing stem cells are transplanted. That's part of evidence-based medicine. There are also, in some instances, it's not necessarily bone marrow. It's umbilical cord blood containing blood stem cells that are transplanted. So again, we can think of this as sort of mainstream supported by safety and efficacy data.
But that's not what you found in the 570 clinics that they're offering. They're not really claiming to do a lot of those things with stem cells.
That's exactly right. I mean, we had inclusion-exclusion criteria, so we didn't include procedures like that. We didn't include, say, medical centers and hospitals doing those procedures. We focused on businesses making, really quite dramatic claims, like claiming they were advertising stem cell therapies for ALS, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, dementia, cerebral palsy, autism. I mean, the list goes on, 20, 30 different diseases and injuries. And that's where the evidence, breaks down. These aren't institutions that have done preclinical research or clinical studies.
Mm-hmm. So that's the bad news. So even though they're making these claims, there's really no good hard data to say that stem cell usage will be productive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated marketplace, and I wouldn't say there's sort of one size fits all. There are a lot of different businesses out there. The kinds of assertions, that they make vary. But if you look on the end that I've just mentioned, I mean, there's just not meaningful safety and efficacy data. Those are the ones that most concern us.
Is there a way to change this and make this stuff work?
Well,
or to test them better?
Well, I think we have mechanisms, in terms of carefully designed studies, properly conducted clinical trials where, you start with preclinical research, then you move to first-in-human safety studies and move on phase 2, phase 3 studies. So, I mean, there are pathways that can be used that, they contain risks. People can be harmed in even carefully conducted studies. But you try and minimize those risks. And when you do all this outside of a, more mainstream clinical research, translational research framework, you run the risk of ratcheting up risk rather than trying to limit it everywhere you can.
All right, Dr. Turner, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Lee Turner, Associate Professor of Bioethics at the University of Minnesota. Quick break. When we come back, I'll look into the research of some of the hidden wounds of war, brain trauma, PTSD, even when it strikes our kids in the battleground of their neighborhoods, sort of what's going on the streets with violence. We'll talk more about it after this break. Support for this podcast comes from Harry's. Ever wonder why shaving is so expensive? Well, it doesn't have to be. You can get a close, comfortable shave at a fraction of the price they charge you at the drugstore. Harry's has a shaving starter set for just $15. That price includes the razor, 3 blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. Here's how Harry's does it. They bought a razor factory in Germany that has been crafting some of the world's highest quality blades for almost a century. And they ship the blades directly from that factory to you, cutting out the middleman and saving you money. And if you go to Harry's.com right now and type in my code Friday with your first purchase, they will give you an additional $5 off. That's HARRYS.com. And enter coupon code Friday at checkout for $5 off the starter set. And start shaving smarter today. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Conflicts around the world have left too many casualties to count. And while there are many visible war wounds, missing limbs, battered flesh, we can also bring hidden injuries to the brain. Just as researchers are starting to pay more attention to the results of repeated head trauma in sports, military doctors are starting to pay more attention to concussions and other traumatic brain injuries on the battlefield. What they have discovered is what we will be talking about for the beginning of the rest of the hour. If you're a vet who's experienced head trauma or live with someone who has, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. 844-724-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guests. John Hamilton is a science correspondent for NPR who has been reporting on military brain research there. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi there. Kit Parker is one of the researchers profiled in John's reports. He's a vet himself, having served two tours in Afghanistan. He's a professor of bioengineering and applied physics at Harvard and a member of the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Howard. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Jeffrey Lieberman is the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons and director of the New York State Psychiatric Institute. He's in our New York studios here. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ira. Nice to be here.
I just want to say, last time you were here, you're really sort of the catalyst for this. When you were here talking about your book last time, I said to you, what was the most understudied piece of psychiatry? And you said it was PTSD, and it really needed to be studied more. So I've been thinking about that since then.
I'm glad I provoked your interest in this follow-up program.
It was actually John Hamilton, who was doing a series of stories on the military that caught my attention. John, what are some of the things the military is doing in this field?
Well, they're doing a couple of things. They have funded a fair amount of research in trying to figure out the sort of biological underpinnings of injuries caused by blasts in battle. They have also changed completely the way they handle these injuries when they occur.
Mm-hmm. Most people think about war wounds as being mainly physical. You have your bullet wounds, lacerations. Are you saying there has been a shift in the thinking of the military here?
I think there has, yeah. I mean, what has happened is that the military has apparently embraced the idea that, yes, there can be, of course, psychological trauma that can affect people who've been in combat. But they're also, especially to these people who have been exposed to blasts from IEDs, that they can actually have a physical injury to their brain. And once they sort of seem to accept that, their feeling about how you handle the situation when somebody is near an explosion has totally changed. It used to be that chances were they would be just sent back in, say, kid, you're fine, go back in, fight again. Now there are rules that require people in combat who have been exposed to an injury or to a blast like that to be pulled out and examined. And the assumption is that they may, in fact, have a physical injury to their brain.
Hmm. Kit Parker, you were in combat yourself. How did you come to study brain trauma?
Well, I was the first time I went to Afghanistan, I wasn't a neuroscientist, or I wasn't even studying traumatic brain injury. But I did a combat tour in Afghanistan. I started a faculty position at Harvard. After that, I was focused on the heart disease, mostly pediatric heart disease. And then a friend of mine was wounded in Iraq, and after a series of phone calls, it became pretty clear that his treatment was not going well. I had had a little bit of discussion with DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, about the status of brain injury research after the use of improvised explosive devices increased on the battlefield. And so one day I was talking to a buddy of mine, and who was wounded. I got pissed, and I decided I should become a neuroscientist if I was going to survive this war with my buddies. So I got into it.
Oh, it's as simple as that. I'm sure it was a lot tougher road than you're making it sound to be, to getting to be. To do what you do. Jeffrey Lieberman, what are some of the symptoms of having a traumatic brain injury?
Well, first, sorry, if I could say that you might be able to say that the military and the NFL got religion in sort of the same way at about the same time. And that is to say that, you know, there's a notion which is understandable but not warranted that if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And the notion was if there's no demonstrable physical signs of an injury, traumatic or otherwise, then it's not real and it's not having any harmful effect.
That's what General Patton, the famous slap of the soldier during World War II was, wasn't it? Sort
exactly.
Of that sort of thing.
He called him a coward as a result of his being affected by the psychological trauma of the war. And worse than that was the fact in the Great War, World War I, where shell shock was first defined, people were shot for cowardice. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that concussions in the NFL are now a big thing with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And the military, in coming to terms with penetrating brain injuries, TBI, traumatic brain injury, and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, are trying to come to grips with the way the most mm-hmm. complicated organ in the body can be affected by different types of insults.
So you have to learn how to recognize that.
Exactly.
Then, right? And now are we learning how to recognize that?
We are, except it's been late in coming and it's going too slowly. Individuals who put themselves in harm's way to defend our nation should be the highest priority of medical research and treatment. And we have a spectrum of injuries that are incurred in the context of combat, from TBI to now this concussive mm-hmm. form of injury, where there's not necessarily the traditional ways of diagnosing it or seeing it, to psychological trauma. And it's been kind of a reluctant, too little, too late process to get on top of it. If this was Ebola, if this was Zika, if this was AIDS, we'd have been all over it.
Mm-hmm. And Kit, you're someone who actually gets down to the cellular level to see what the damage is, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Tell us what you see. What happens in the brain and what happens to the nerves and the cells?
So there's two schools of thought. It used to be that some type of dramatic injury to the brain would kill neurons. But now we realize that much smaller mechanical blows, or smaller magnitude mechanical blows to the head, the same thing that causes a concussion, can injure neurons, doesn't necessarily kill them. And what we find is that when these neurons are injured, they start to retract, they disconnect from the neural networks, the networks of cells that are in the brain that allow you to count your change when you're at a fast food restaurant, or recognize your friend, or to do any type of computation that you might do. They start to disconnect, and these networks, you see a maladaptive adjustment. They don't reform right now. That's the current state of the art. We don't know how to get them to rewire up so that you can counter change, that you can perform all the tasks that you customarily do. So any disruption to those neurons, but we also learned from blast traumatic brain injury, that you can have a disruption to the blood vessels in the brain. Those vessels, the brain's a very metabolically expensive organ. It eats a lot of energy, and you have to have a lot of blood flowing up there. In blast traumatic brain injury, we found that those blood vessels can be damaged. These soldiers are coming back with a cerebral basal spasm. That's something that you don't customarily see with a football player who's been concussed. So there was different kinds of traumatic brain injury, and this goes back to years ago. The Center for Disease Control was talking about the epidemic of traumatic brain injury even before 9/11, because of three-point safety belts and cars were passengers were constrained by a seatbelt, but the head would snap back and forth, and your brain would literally smash up against the inside of your skull. And so we had TBIs for a long time, but between the NFL's retired players, between soldiers on the battlefield, when you start having a 25-year-old kid who's been, you know, concussed 12 different times on the battlefield, and he's starting to have trouble sleeping by the time he's 30, we have a pretty serious problem on our hands. I'd like to speak for just a moment to Jeff's point about too little, too late. One of the challenges we have here is that the National Institute of Health has been very slow to get into the game on traumatic brain injury. And it's as if they think that any soldier suffering traumatic brain injury is the responsibility of DOD or the Veterans Administration. And that's certainly not the case. Veterans are Americans, too. The NIH's mission is to concern themselves with the health care issues that confront Americans. And NIH has been pretty slow on this.
I couldn't agree more.
Oh, I don't think many of us understood that. I'm glad you brought that point up. John, how did you end up connecting with Dr. Parker and some of the other researchers you talked to in your reporting, and why them?
I was interested in two things. I cover a lot of brain science, and so I was really interested in learning more about, like everybody, I'd been reading all the reports about the amount of traumatic brain injury, the number of concussions happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I mean, the numbers are pretty staggering. The military itself has estimated more than 300,000 people who fought in those wars ended up with some, at least one traumatic brain injury. And that's a lot of people. So I was very interested in learning more about what was happening. How could, you know, how was that translating into these long-term symptoms that people were having? The problems with memory or the problems with thinking, the problems sometimes with emotions and emotional control. So that was one part of it. At the same time, I was fascinated with doing stories about scientists looking at why they did the research they did. What compelled them? What was the thing that motivated them? And so with Dr. Parker, it was a combination of this really interesting brain science, and he was really a guy on a mission and a very personal, with a very personal motivation.
Kit Parker, you know, we keep hearing, we've done reports on the NFL and the search for the safe helmet, and we keep hearing that there is no such thing as a safe helmet that is going to guarantee you're not getting a concussion when you get hit in the head. Is there anything in the military? Is there anything that can be done to help prevent this happening on the battlefield?
Well, preventing exposure to blast is probably the biggest thing. Prevention is the big part of it. You're right. Helmets only help so much, but there's no helmet to put in between the brain and the inside of the skull. So, and that's where a lot of the injuries are going to occur. So we do a couple of things in the military. We wear a blast dosimeter so we can tell how much the soldier's been exposed to blast. So if you've been exposed to a really big blast, we can sit you down. We can get you to the docks to get treated. We have obviously built various vehicles that are designed to offer protection against blast. And a lot of that's penetrating shrapnel from blast injuries. But there's not a whole lot. We have evolved some clinical protocols that help quite a bit. I mean, if I was going to get a concussion several years ago when I was a member of the GRADE team in 2011, I would have much rather been treated in Afghanistan than in the U.S. And hopefully some of those lessons learned from the battlefield are going to make it to civilian clinics.
Jeffrey Lieberman, are these permanent? I mean, are there permanent changes in the brain that it cannot be reversed once these things...
It really depends on the level of severity and the depth of the pathology that Kit was describing before. But I think, you know, when you look at insults that occur, whether it's from an IED explosion, a headbutt on a football field, or a soccer player, you know, heading a ball, just like trauma in life, you know, being attacked, you know, losing a loved one, being in an earthquake, these things are ubiquitous and they're going to occur. And you can try and prevent all you want, but you're never going to stop them. So in addition to the preventative efforts that Kit was describing, I think the other direction that science needs to go on is to look at how do you promote neural resilience? How do you promote, you know, the resilience and the neurotrophic and neurogenetic capacities? So there in the future, I would think, will be protocols to either inoculate before individuals go into theaters of combat or even into athletic competition, or after they do suffer a concussion, that could promote neural resilience in the form of either neurotrophic. You had on in the segment before the stem cells, which is it's like 21st century scientific snake oil, but it's an exaggeration of what actually would be possible in some way.
I'm Myra Plato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about PTSD with John Hamilton, Kit Parker, and Jeffrey Lieberman. I am surprised to hear, and I'll ask all of you about you mentioned the lack of attention paid by the NIH to this disease, thinking, well, it's the Pentagon's problem, and the Pentagon is there a middle ground, or is it going to take a sea change like we heard with the football players and the NFL to finally admit there might be a problem
I'd like to speak to that. I've only published a few papers in traumatic brain injuries. I've gotten into this, and I've spent a lot of time traveling the country, speaking to alumni groups from Harvard, trying to raise money for the university. People could care less about the heart research that I do, but anyone who knows someone who's been concussed is very concerned about the possibility that they might get Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, or some other type of neurodegenerative disease that we can track back to traumatic brain injuries. So the public's interest in there is there. A lot of it's been fueled by publications like USA Today, who did a fantastic job of keeping this on the front page for a long time. But it hasn't gotten into the Beltway yet, and those lobbyists for patient advocacy groups that suffer from autism and Alzheimer's have got that budget at National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke carved up, and it's a zero-sum game. No one's going to get something unless someone loses something. And so that's the biggest challenge we face now, I think, inside the Beltway in terms of getting funding is a proper advocate.
I think it's more than a proper advocate, but I completely agree with Kit. It's to get wonky about this. The federal budget is $4 trillion. The NIH budget is $31 billion. That's like 0.8%. It's divided up among the different disease areas and organ systems and populations. And it's a zero-sum game. So if you give more to one, you have to take away from another. And it's the squeaking wheel that gets the grease when Congress micromanages how the NIH gives money. And if they are going to micromanage, they should be micromanaging for the things that the public and are prioritized in terms of the public interest. And how can you say that something rises above this in priority?
Well, yeah, you know, and to talk about veterans has become a big political football this year. In this election, you would think someone would say more about taking care of the vets.
You would think, but Kit, I think, was correct there. First of all, the idea, TBI people will get into and believe, when it devolves into concussive effects and PTSD, where you can't see it, you can't diagnose it. I had a general who was trying to understand the basis of this increasing suicide and PTSD problem, and I was telling him about the research that we were doing in terms of neurobiology, and he said, well, come up with a diagnostic test so we can find out who's faking it. And the whole thing, the idea of some psychological injury is anathema to military ethos, which is why it took so long to be accepted. And it the responsibility for researching it and treating it was defaulted to VA and DOD, which meant the NIH wasn't funding it and bringing in maybe the top scientists who otherwise weren't funding this area, of weren't studying this area of research before. And that needs to be changed.
All right. We're going to talk about more when we come back. And we're going to take a break and bring on another guest to talk about PTSD. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Support for this podcast comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes to make delicious home-cooked meals for less than $10 per meal. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest standards for their suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. New recipes are created each week, and they are not repeated within a year. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. I'm a Blue Apron consumer, and my favorite meal so far is lemon butter salmon. Mmm. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Check out this week's menu and get two meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/science. That's blueapron.com/science. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. In case you just joined us, we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder in the military and the research or a lack of research to understand it completely. We've been talking about these injuries, what they do inside the brain. And joining me now is Daniel Pearl. He's director of the Neuropathology Corps in the Center for Neuroscience and Regenerative Medicine at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, and he is author of a recent research paper in the journal Lancet Neurology looking at the effects of brain trauma in the military. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Good to be there.
Thank you. I understand you looked at samples of brain tissue taken from soldiers during autopsy, and what did you find there?
Well, basically, we found that the service members who had been exposed to blasts, such as improvised explosive devices, IEDs, showed a very unique and distinct pattern of scarring in the brain, which we believe is related to their exposure to these high explosives. We compared these cases to civilians who had been in things like automobile accidents where there was no blast exposure, and they didn't show this pattern of scarring.
Do these brain abnormalities that you're seeing show up in scans without having to do the before, you know, if you don't do the autopsy?
We've been trying to see if we can find this abnormality with scans, and so far they haven't shown up. It's one of the reasons why this is referred to as the invisible wound. the scans are really marvelous, but you know, they have their limitations, and so far we haven't been able to see these abnormalities on scans.
So if you scanned a living soldier with that and expected to find, you know, what we were talking about before, Dr. Lieberman was saying, you know, the military says we don't have a definitive way. This would not be a definitive way either, to say that.
So far, we have not been able to identify this or diagnose it in living individuals. But now that we know what we're looking for, we know what the change looks like, I think we'll have better ways of devising means by which we can make that diagnosis. But it hasn't happened yet.
Mm. And you can see in the brains that you autopsy, you can see that there has been damage. Is the damage in those areas that would be relevant to PTSD, linked to PTSD?
Yes. I mean, PTSD is, you know, it's a very complex condition. There may be many areas of the brain that are dysfunctional in PTSD. And, of course, there is the whole psychiatric aspect to it. But when we look at where these areas of damage have occurred, they do mm-hmm. correlate with parts of the brain that are have been shown to be dysfunctional in other studies in patients with mm-hmm. PTSD.
Let me get some responses from my other guests.
John Hamilton here.
Let me get
John, go ahead.
You can go first. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say we have been talking about these injuries as being completely invisible, and I think that's not quite the case anymore. There are hints, more than hints now, that certain technologies are able to see at least some of the damage that is occurring in the brains of service members who have been exposed to a blast. And for instance, at Washington University in St. Louis, there's a guy named David Brody who has been doing studies using a technology called diffusion tensor MRI, which is able to look at the connections in the brain. And he has seen abnormalities in those connections in people who've been exposed to a blast. So it's possible that the technology is coming along now where some of these invisible injuries are becoming visible.
Mm-hmm. Ira, I would like to speak.
Yes, Dr. Parker, go ahead.
I'd like to speak this TBI versus PTSD, because this has been pretty controversial for several years. For years, people were thinking that TBI was really just PTSD. And I'll tell you, imagine this. Imagine that I put someone to sleep, and I pull the amygdala out of their brain, and I put it on a table. The amygdala is an emotional center in your brain, and I smash it with a hammer, and then I put it back inside their brain. And they wake up, and maybe they're a little sad, maybe they're depressed. So are you going to say that this person has PTSD, or are you going to say that they have TBI? And I think this John's point is really important. We can see some of these things now with David's work out there at WashU. It's important to distinguish that there is something called PTSD, there is something called TBI. There can be crosstalk between these two diseases, and we really aren't quite understanding how to distinguish or treat the two different ones. But imagine this for PTSD. You take a young warfighter and you put him out there on a battlefield, and you take his brain and you soak it with testosterone, you soak it with cortisol, you soak it with adrenaline, and you put him in a situation where his life is on the line. But that's not the worst part. The worst part is the moral jeopardy of the decisions that you face every day and the decisions you make on a battlefield. Once you pull them out of that environment, there have been changes to that brain. We don't know exactly what they are, but I can tell you there's changes to that brain, and how they adapt to that non-threat environment is one of the biggest challenges that these young veterans and older veterans too face when they come off the battlefield. And whether or not that's PTSD or moral injury or some type of other post-combat stress thing, we throw mm-hmm. everything in the bucket of PTSD. It needs to be a little bit more granular.
Last word, Dr. Lieberman.
The notion that these are visible or invisible is an arbitrarily defined one. When Dr. Pearl's article was published in Lancet, there was an article in the New York Times that said, what if PTSD is not psychological but is physical? And the reality is that the tools to discern these, whether it's postmortem or antemortem, are available, but the effort hasn't been put into doing it. You were kind enough to have me on when I had written a book previously called Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. And if you just permit me 10 seconds, I'd just like to read a passage which I think speaks to mm-hmm. this issue. the brain is the only organ that can suffer what we might call existential disease, where its operation is disrupted not by physical injury or by impalpable experience, but by impalpable experience. Every other organ in the body requires physical stimulus to generate illness, toxins, infections, blunt force trauma, strangulation, but only the brain can become ill from incorporeal stimuli such as loneliness, humiliation, betrayal, moral failure. Getting fired from a job, abandoned by a spouse, experiencing an IED, watching your best combat buddy eviscerated, watching your child run over by a car, losing your retirement savings to theft. The brain is the interface between the ethereal and the organic, where the feelings and memories comprising the ineffable fabric of experience are transmuted into molecular biochemistry.
All right. That's going to be the last word, because it's a very good segue to our next segment about the children in neighborhoods coming down with PTSD. I want to thank Daniel Pearl. John Hamilton is science correspondent for NPR. You can hear his recent reports about the military brain research there. Kit Parker, a member of the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering, and Jeffrey Lieberman, director of New York State Psychiatric Institute. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. And we will not let go of this image. We'll be covering it some more. We have been talking about the effects of war on the brains of people in combat and the possible, as I say, connection to PTSD. But traumatic events are not limited to the military. Many of the victims are children, victims of an ongoing battle on the street, trauma taking the form of exposure to gun violence in our cities. You have car accidents, physical and sexual abuse. Joining me now to talk about PTSD in children and how to help them overcome trauma is Judith Cohen. She's a professor of psychiatry at Drexel University College of Medicine and medical director of the Center for Traumatic Stress in Children and Adolescents, Allegheny Health Network in Pittsburgh. She's also a developer of the trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So are children children out on the street? I mean, they're exposed and vulnerable. How common is PTSD in kids?
PTSD is very common in children. Your listeners may be surprised to learn that 2/3 of all children experience at least one trauma before they reach adulthood, and 1/3 experience multiple traumas. And of exposed children, about 20% develop significant PTSD symptoms. So that's a lot of kids.
What are the symptoms, and how can parents recognize them?
Well, that's another challenge. So the symptoms of PTSD in children are the same as they are in adults. So they're often kids have intrusive memories or intrusive nightmares about the trauma. And that can be difficult because in young children especially, they might have scary thoughts or scary nightmares. And if the parent doesn't know about the trauma, it can be really difficult for the parent to know. They might have just general scary nightmares. A lot of kids have nightmares anyway. And one of the really challenging things is the kids are avoidant, and adults are too, when they have PTSD, and they don't want to talk about or remember the scary thing. So that's one of the real challenges recognizing it.
Does that mean that kids growing up in stressful environments like poverty, violent neighborhoods, gun battles between gangs, things like that, or are more likely to be affected?
Yes, sure. Kids who are exposed to community violence are very vulnerable to developing PTSD. And we know that many of the kids in these neighborhoods do develop those difficulties.
Psychiatrists want to throw drugs at the kids?
Yes, often they do. And unfortunately, we know that there is no evidence that shows that any medication is effective for treating child PTSD. The psychotherapies are much more helpful. But unfortunately, medications are very commonly used, even though they are not effective.
Let me go to the phones, because they've been lit up and we've had such a long discussion. It's been a good one. Let me go to Rockville, Maryland. Patrice, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and I was working with the Army in a clinic in Germany, and I recently took over a position in an outpatient clinic, a nonprofit outpatient clinic, where we provide care to all kinds of different people. But I have noticed that a lot of the clients that we're seeing, at first I thought it was me seeing TBI everywhere, but now I am realizing that there's a lot of patients that come in. I realize your discussion is on children, but I think it's a similar situation for a lot of children. But a lot of my patients come in and they do have were domestic violence or, you know, got into boxing or, you know, got hit in the head with a bat on the street during a fight. And I am seeing symptoms that are pretty clear to me as a TBI. Obviously, your discussion right now is more focused on PTSD, and I could address that as well. But it is something that I think people think soldiers have TBIs or PTSD, and that a person who was functioning well and is all of a sudden extremely irritable or not themselves, that they're not getting the full care that they should be getting.
All right, Patrice, thanks for calling. We'll pick that up on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Dr. Cohen, what do you think? Do you see patients like that too?
Well, I see children and adolescents, but certainly we see kids who have, had concussions and, gotten sports injuries as well. But I think it's important that we're aware of their trauma history as well. So when children have injuries like that we ask about their trauma history as well, because it's important when they have a change or they're hyperactive or they have difficulties in concentrating that we take into consideration their past trauma history as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to Stella in Lafayette, California. Hi, Stella. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. How are you, Ira?
Fine. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a personal history. My mother, who is now 87, suffered tremendous trauma during the Nazi occupation of Greece in 1941 to 45 when she was 12 to 16. She says her grandfather was executed. Her family village of 34-story towers in the Mani Peninsula was raided in 1943, and all of the residents, including my mother, were forced from their homes in the dark of night. Their valuables were stolen. All else was burned. And then the stone homes were cannonballed as retribution for resistance actions. Really traumatic. My mother had me at 41, and as a young child, I knew something was off with her. She hoarded newspapers. She ate food out of the garbage. Tremendously disturbing to me, but I'm so grateful that I learned of her past in 2012 when she was 83. I think... You know, there's something about that population, the Greeks, they didn't want to talk about that time in their history. And it's a real, maybe survival technique, but there's an there's an alternative, which is the Jewish populations of Eastern Europe, which talk about the Holocaust tremendously.
All right, Stella.
While it can't remove the negative, it is very positive and therapeutic
all
to
right.
talk about.
Thanks for your contribution. That is an interesting story. Just to sum up with Dr. Cohen, what kinds of therapy does work for children?
Yes, and I think Stella's point is very important, that there are effective treatments. And just as Stella was saying, the difference between effective treatments and usual treatments are, just as she was saying, that it's very important to encourage children to be, to talk about their experiences. And many typical therapists wait until children are ready to talk. And as I was saying, children are often avoidant, and they will not spontaneously talk about it. And through the federally funded National Child Traumatic Stress Network, effective treatments are available in every state across the country. And these evidence-based treatments have three differences from usual treatments. First of all, they provide specific skills to master reminders about the trauma. Secondly, parents or caregivers are actively included. And thirdly, we do help children directly face their fears. We know that facing children's fears instead of avoiding them or waiting until the child, is ready, which often doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And talking about their personal trauma experiences is really important.
Not to interrupt, where can parents go? I mean, if this is such a niche, so to speak, where do they find help?
Well, I suggest, they go to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network website, nctsn.org. As I said, there are therapists across the country. They can find therapists trained in evidence-based treatments in their area. There are websites that provide therapists, for example, the Trauma-Focused Cognitive Behavioral Therapy website, tfcbt.org, has therapists listed by zip code or by state. You can find a trained therapist in your area, or you can ask your pediatrician if you're concerned about your child. Your pediatrician can refer you to a therapist who can evaluate your child if you have concerns.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Judith Cohen, professor of psychiatry at Drexel University College of Medicine, medical director of the Center for Traumatic Stress in Children and Adolescents at Allegheny Health Network in Pittsburgh. It's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the production partners right here at the City University of New York. A very important topic we covered today. If you missed any of it, you have someone who'd like to listen or you think should listen to it, we'll have it up there in a digital in a few hours. Go to our website, sciencefriday.com. We already have our material up there, and you can read the articles and wait for our digital to come up a little bit later this evening. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.